Live FM, KJZA Radio, Drake, Prescott, Williams, Cottonwood, Flagstaff, Arizona. Your national public radio and community programs connection. Coming up next, it's Dr. John Nay and the program Dinosaurs, Science, and the Bible. And be sure to listen at 9:30 this morning for Gerald Rogers and the program The Mountain Gardener from Waters Garden Center in Prescott.
The Lord is good, His mercy endureth forever.
Greetings and welcome to the 25th edition of Dinosaur Science in the Bible with religion professor Dr. John Nay. Now, last week we were talking about the flood and all the repercussions that happened with that. Dr. John, what do you have for us this week?
Well, what I'd like to do this morning, Dave, is to kind of summarize the last 2 weeks. We have been dealing with the flood of Genesis as to whether or not that flood was a global flood or a local flood. Session before last, we talked about the flood, local or global, from a biblical perspective. Then the next week, we talked about support for what we find in the Bible in the world around us. So today I'd like to summarize those two somewhat, and then I'd like to transition into a very controversial topic, and that's the topic of the age of Earth. The age of Earth, the age of the universe, and talk about the dating methods and how they work. Well, Dave, I don't know about you, but my dating methods in high school certainly didn't work very well. But I've learned a few things since then, and perhaps our session this morning will be of some help to those of you listening that are really struggling with your dating methods. So back to the flood. Well, the flood of Genesis, a local flood or a global flood from a biblical perspective. Well, I would pray if you were able to join us on that particular session and the session last week where we summarized that, that you would be clear in your mind that the Bible clearly presents the flood of Genesis, Noah's flood, as a global flood. It's just as if God went out of His way to make it as clear as possible that He is not referring to some local flood between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in that part of the world, Mesopotamia, which means between the rivers, some local flood there, nor the formation of the Black Sea as presented on a documentary on the Discovery Channel, but in fact a global flood. He gave us the covenant of the rainbow as a sign that He would never again do what He did then. Well, again, if that flood were, in fact, a local flood, then every time there's a local flood, whether it be between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers or the Black Sea or anywhere on earth, God would be breaking that covenant promise. We looked at several passages of Scripture in Genesis chapter 7, verses 18 through 23, where when you read that passage, it's emphatic. It's stressed. All of the entire heavens under the earth were covered with water, and on it's just, again, stressed that we're not speaking of a local flood. If, in fact, it were a local flood, well, what would hold the waters in place if all of the highest mountains were covered to a depth of 15 cubits? Jesus referred to the flood as a global flood in Matthew 24, 37 through 39. Peter referred to the flood as a global flood in 1 Peter chapter 3. From a biblical perspective, again, there should be no question. Well, we moved from that session week before last to last week's session, where God has given us a tremendous empirical support for what He says in His inspired Word. We can look around if we struggle a little bit with our faith in God's Word, and our faith isn't necessarily God said it, I believe it, and that settles it for me, but there are some doubts there. God gave us empirical proof that this flood was, in fact, a global flood. Because with a global flood, a duration of over one solar year in duration, which I've never heard of a local flood of that kind of time, if, in fact, Earth was underwater for this extended time period, what should we see on the Earth today? We should find tremendous depositions of sedimentary deposition, or in other words, water laying down deposition, and we find that all over the Earth, on the highest mountains of the Earth. And within this sedimentary deposition, there should be billions upon billions of organics, things that were alive, that are dead and buried, and a mind-boggling amount of fossilization on a global scale. And that's exactly what we find. Looking at the Earth before the flood, the world of that time, as said in 1 Peter 3:5 and following, that was deluged and destroyed, that world before the flood, we're talking about an Earth of a temperate climate. We talked about that when we talked about the second day of the creation week and the water vapor canopy that protected Earth from ultraviolet light and other X-rays and cosmic rays that would be harmful to organics and to exponentially to everything really on Earth as they would relate. And this temperate climate, all of this foliage being uprooted, this deluge, the waters rising over a period of 150 days, all of this seismic activity, we should find tremendous proof of temperate climate foliage before the flood. And in fact, of course, we do, as we talked about last week, an estimated 14 trillion tons of coal found on planet Earth. It takes, again, approximately 7 cubic foot of plant foliage to form 1 cubic foot of coal, realizing coal are different hardnesses, three different hardnesses, and eventually diamonds if you're in the right spot. But the bottom line is we have tremendous proof of the world before the flood being different climatically and topographically and geographically than the Earth we're on today. It's the same planet, but vastly, vastly different. So we looked at coal, and we talked about the tremendous amount of coal that we find on Earth, vividly attesting to the world before the flood, and vividly attesting to the factuality of the flood we find in Genesis chapters 6 through 9, the flood of Noah. The fossilization that is found, again, on a global scale, mind-boggling amounts. I won't put you through all of that shared last week, but the fossil beds that are found on a global scale, many of them at very high elevation in the highest mountains, again, vividly attesting to the global flood, the factuality of the flood of the book of Genesis. One that I just started on and didn't touch in much detail, and I won't this morning either, but that's petroleum. Tremendous petroleum reserves. You might recall in some parts of the country where there's the Sinclair service station chain. And, of course, on their sign, they have a picture of Dino. And what are we doing with the dinosaur on a service station sign chain? Well, the bottom line is most believe that the petroleum reserves are vestigial, or what's left of, billions upon billions of dinosaurs and other organic substances, but primarily organics, not as much plant foliage as with coal. Well, the gas reserves, again, found on a global scale. I have an article here taken from the New York Times some time back. Arctic may hold big oil and gas deposits. The ice-cloaked Arctic Ocean was once apparently a warm, biologically brewing basin so rich in sinking organic material that some scientists examining fresh evidence pulled from a submerged ridge near the North Pole say the seabed may now hold significant oil and gas deposits. Well, this article here, I have many of these in my my files at home, again, attesting to different climatic conditions on planet Earth. And if you take to task and do a little study on your own through the Internet or wherever on the formation of petroleum and the speculation relative to where it came from, and you read the rationale as far as the proposals of where petroleum came from, the same with coal and the same with the fossils, the fossil record, and you take a look at what is presented to support what is seen, from the evolution side, and then take a look at the same physical things from a biblical perspective, and see which really makes the most sense. In reference to the fossils again, as I mentioned last week, we're talking about just thousands upon thousands upon thousands of local floods where conditions were just right, and you have this sudden deluge, this rush of water down a canyon, whatever, and these animals seeking shelter and being trapped, and the sediment being deposited upon them very, very quickly, and conditions being right for fossilization to take place. Well, we don't have fossilization on planet Earth anywhere near the scale of what we find, and what we find vividly attest to, a catastrophic event never equaled in the history of this planet relative to the planet itself. So anyway, very interesting things to look into. When I have the opportunity to fly, I'm leaving this next month, going up to Alaska to do some creation science, and I look forward to flying because as we take off, as we land, I look down, and at least through my personal paradigm of this planet, planet Earth that God created, I see devastation. I see an enormous seabed on a global scale. Well, I want to take a moment. There's so much on the flood that we could go into, so many questions that I haven't begun to give you information on yet, just simply because of time. But I want to take a little time out here on the age of Earth, the universe, and how these radiometric dating methods work. I mean, how do scientists come up with this 18 to 20 billion years for the cosmos and 4.5 to 4.6 billion years for planet Earth? Now, if you've been following our programs on Sunday morning, we began many weeks ago taking to task the length of the creation days. Spent five, maybe six sessions on that. And when we walked away from that, from a biblical perspective, it would appear clear that the creation days were, in fact, literal consecutive days of 24 hours or less in duration. Well, that's a pretty blatant thing to say. And again, we spent like 5 or 6 weeks on this to see what the Bible clearly presented. And I, of course, believe that it does clearly present that. Well, everyone knows, you know, we're living in a universe that's tremendously old. Well, everyone knows that. Well, how do we know that? You know, how do scientists go about determining the age of the Earth and the universe? So at this point, I want to go into this, and we probably won't get this all covered in this particular session, but bear with me if you will. Okay, how do scientists determine the age of fossils and rocks and planet Earth to begin with? Well, there's something in geology referred to as uniformitarianism, which is foundational, really, to all dating methods, including the radiometric dating methods like potassium argon or carbon-14. And uniformitarianism is defined in this way, quote, "The doctrine that all geologic changes may be explained by existing physical and chemical processes, such as erosion, deposition, volcanic action, etc., that have operated in," here's the key part here, "essentially the same way throughout geologic time." Perhaps if you've taken a geology course or just a basic science course, you've heard the term "the present is the key to the past." Well, basically, it works like this. Let's say you went to the Grand Canyon, and you went down to the Colorado River, and you're going to do a little experimentation on your own. And you placed stakes in the riverbed 100 yards apart. And you came back in 10 years. And you found that overall, the Colorado River had eroded the riverbed 1/64th of an inch in those 10 years. Well, okay, now the uniformitarianistic approach would be, if you believe that the Grand Canyon was cut by the Colorado River, well, that's 1/64th of an inch in 10 years. Well, 64 times 10 is 640 years. So, in other words, it takes right at 640 years to cut 1 inch down into the canyon. Now you take and you measure the wall going up the Grand Canyon, Well, we're talking mighty tall wall, like 1 mile. Okay, well, every inch then would be 640 years. And you'd come away with a tremendous amount of time for the formation of the Grand Canyon. Now, on the surface, you know, that appears, well, you know, what's wrong with that? That looks pretty good. Let me give you another illustration. Perhaps one time you've taken a tour of Carlsbad Caverns or some other caverns that had stalactites and stalagmites and calcite shaws, and you're shown these beautiful stalactites hanging from the ceiling of the cave, and these stalagmites coming up from the base of the cave, and the tour guide's given you this story for how this came about. Generally, that encompasses millions and millions and millions of years. Well, you said, I want to run my own little experiment here. So you take a stalagmite, and as your tour moves on through the cave, you stay back there, and you measure this stalagmite. And you determine the volume of the stalagmite. Okay, and you mark that stalagmite so you can find it again, that particular one. Well, 10 years later, you come back, and you join that tour again. And you come up to this stalagmite, the one that you'd marked. Well, you measure this stalagmite to determine its value, and you find out this stalagmite has grown 1/64th of an inch cubed, and it took 10 years. Its volume increased 1/64th of an inch cubed. Now, you want to know how old this guy is. Now, you take and you do a little basic math on this, and you're going to come up, for every 1/64th of an inch cubed, 10 years, you're going to come up with this tremendous time period. And again, this sounds very reasonable on the surface. Well, let's take another illustration to get the basics of this, if we might. Well, you're out here wandering through the woods, and you're by yourself. You know, what does this tell you? Well, you have no social life, more likely. But at any rate, you're wandering through the woods, and you get lost, and you come up to this cabin, and you knock on the cabin door, and there no one comes to the door. You can't see anyone around, but you look inside the window, and you see there's a candle that's on a table, and the candle is lit. And again, you knock, no one answers. You open the door, and you go in, you look around, you can't find anyone. I'm wondering how long it's been since there's been someone here. So I run a little experiment. I take this candle, I measure this candle, and I find out this candle that is burning is 7 inches tall. Well, now I'm going to mark this candle at 1-inch increments. And again, of course, since I have no social life, I'm going to sit there and watch it burn. Nothing else to do anyway. And in 2 hours, the candle burns 2 inches. Wow. Okay, well, now I know that when I came into the cabin, the candle had been burning for 5 hours. Well, how do I know that? Well, first of all, I'm assuming that the candle was 12 inches tall when it was lit. And that assumption is based upon another assumption that the average candle today is 12 inches tall. So now, if this candle were 12 inches tall when it was lit, and it's burning at the rate of 1 inch per hour, in 5 hours, it would only be 7 inches tall, the height that it was when I measured it, when I came into the cabin. So it had been 5 hours since there had been someone there. Well, how do you like that? How do you like my conclusion that it had been burning for 5 hours? Well, of course, that conclusion is based upon other things that are assumed to be true, other presuppositions, if you will. I'm assuming it was 12 inches tall when it was lit. I'm assuming that it burned 1 inch per hour. Now, I'm also assuming, and if you get to thinking about this a little bit, I'm also assuming that the candle was not put out and relighted, and put out and relighted. Well, I'm also assuming that that candle wasn't tapered, where it burned faster initially and perhaps burned slower as there was more volume of the candle. And I'm also assuming that climatic conditions remained constant in there, and someone didn't have a window open and the wind was blowing through and it burned at a faster rate. Well, if all of my assumptions are in fact true, my conclusion that the candle had been burning for 5 hours, that would be a good conclusion. But what happens if any one of those presuppositions is wrong? It completely throws out my conclusion. What if the candle were only 8 inches tall when it was initially lit? you know, what if the candle were 8 inches tall when it was initially lit, and it was put out and relit and put out and relit, and in between the being put out and being relighted, that was a year went by, because this is a guy that came up here just to hunt, and he was only there for the hunting season. So how are you tracking with me? You know, we're assuming, and if all of the assumptions are in fact valid, then our conclusion can have some validity to it. I mentioned stalagmite a little bit ago. I have a picture in my records taken years ago of a bat that's encased in a stalagmite. Well, the interesting thing is, this bat has not decomposed. Not only that, it hasn't putrefied. It hasn't rotted either, okay? Well, what does this tell you about this bat? Slow-flying bat. What does it tell you about the growth rate of a stalagmite? It tells you a stalagmite can grow very, very, very rapidly. It's dependent upon the conditions being right. So initially, the doctrine, if you will, or the teaching of uniformitarianism, which again says the present is the key to the past, the influx of cosmic rays into our cosmos is the same now as it's always been, the influx of high nickel content dust into our atmosphere is the same now as it's always been. Yeah, initially, again, this sounds very good. But when you take it to task, and especially if you give a conclusion without giving the presuppositions to the conclusion, it can be very, very misleading. You know, generally when you read something about a date, whether it be a newspaper on the latest fossil find or something on National Geographic, the National Geographic Channel, carbon-14 has yielded a date of da-da-da-da for this particular specimen. But it does not give you all the things that are assumed to be true that would lead to that conclusion. How are we doing this morning? Are you tracking with me on this? Okay? And you don't have to be a scientist in this, but it's good for us to understand that, of course, when you read something, we have a choice as to whether or not we accept it to be true or not. And that often relates to the faith that we have placed in the source of that information. And even we as a culture, collectively, generally speaking, would put more credibility for illustration purposes in National Geographic than we would in National Enquirer. So again, we're back to faith. But for our program this morning, I just want to simply share with you that the dating methods are based upon presuppositions, and if the presuppositions are in fact valid, then the conclusion can have some validity to it. But if in fact there is one assumption that in fact is an error, it completely throws out the conclusion. So our illustration with the candle, you know, we're assuming it was 12 inches tall when it was lighted. We're assuming that the candle had not been put out and relighted and put out and relighted. We're assuming that the candle wasn't tapered. We're assuming the density of the wick was constant. We're assuming the density of the wax was constant from the top to the bottom. We're assuming that climatic conditions in the cabin remain constant. And on we go. And if anyone, again, is wrong, it throws out the conclusions. Well, let's take carbon-14 here, just as an illustration. There are several different radiometric dating methods. Carbon-14 is one that at least people in my generation were exposed to some extent when we were in school. And carbon-14 is it's a dating method for dating things that were alive at one time, that were organic, if you will. And the bottom line is, the way it works, cosmic rays enter our atmosphere, and as cosmic rays enter our atmosphere, they produce fast-moving neutrons. Those are those little guys that aren't positive or negative, they're neutral. And these neutrons strike nitrogen, and about 78% of our atmosphere is composed of nitrogen. And these fast-moving neutrons striking nitrogen, it produces carbon-14. Carbon-14 simply has two more protons than carbon-12, ordinary carbon. Well, it becomes an isotope. It's radioactive. It's unstable. Now, maybe a way to share this would be, if you were to take your battery out of your car, okay, where it's no longer being charged through the alternator or generator, if you have a really, really old car, and you take this battery out and you set it on the ground, and you leave it there and you come back in 2 weeks. Well, let's just say you measured this battery, you tested the battery when you took it out of the car, and just for mathematic purposes, let's just say it's 600 amps, okay, cranking, cold cranking power. And you come back, you set it on the ground, it's the dead of winter, and you come back in 2 weeks, and you check the amperage. And again, just to keep the math simple, let's say there's 300 amps. Okay. Well, you went from 600 amps to 300 amps. That's 300, of course, is half of 600. And it took 2 weeks to do that. So you could say that this is the half-life of this battery. Okay, the battery was charged, just like an isotope is charged, and it's no longer being charged. You take it out of the car, you put it on the ground, okay, and now it begins to run down. That's second law of thermodynamics, one of the laws relative to dealing with matter and dealing with energy. Okay, so the battery runs down to 300 amps. Now, if you were going to take the uniformitarianistic view of this, you're going to say, well, in another 2 weeks, there should be only 150 amps, et cetera, et cetera. And that's basically how the equation works with the radiometric dating methods. We assume the charge, if you will, of isotope and whatever it is, this bone, let's say, we assume it to be whatever amount. We do a little testing over a limited time period, and then we postulate or propose it takes so many years to reach half of its charge. Carbon-14, for example, 56 to 5700 years, depending on the book you read, that's the half-life. Now, let's see if we have a handle on this thing. Yeah, you have a dinosaur out here eating veggies. Oh, what I didn't mention, that when this carbon-14 combines with carbon dioxide, and thus it enters the food chain through plants. Through plants, veggies, okay. Man or animals come along, let's say animal comes along and eats the plant. Man comes along and eats the animal or eats the plant, and he's taking in carbon-14. All of us have carbon-14 in our system now, okay? And we continue to do that until we die. Or in other words, until we are disconnected from the alternator and placed out on the ground, or in our case, in the ground, okay? And once that happens, that charge, if you will, of carbon-14, that carbon-14 begins to degenerate back into carbon-12. So we're running downhill here. So you're going along and you find a bone. You're a paleontologist. And you take this bone and you test this bone and you find out it contains, for illustration purposes, 12 units of carbon-14. Now, we're going to assume that this animal contained 24 units when it was alive. So this animal dies, and this 24 begins to degenerate. He begins to discharge, let's say, until the point where you dig up the bone. And you dig up the bone, and it has 12 units. Well, of course, 12 is half of 24, and the half-life of carbon-14, again, depending upon the book that you read, is somewhere around 5,600 years. Well, now this bone, you know, this bone is 5,600 years old because it contains half of what it is assumed to have had at the point that it dies. Now, I can see that our time's running down. I'm just going on and on here, Dave, and I'll put you to sleep and perhaps some of the listeners this morning. And I'm going to have to come back on this simply because I run out of time a little bit. And maybe I can make it a little bit clearer, okay? Again, we're going to come down to faith. What we read, where we read it, and the credibility that we place in the source of that information. And unfortunately, there is another story relative to the dating methods and how reliable they are that it has been just basically censored meticulously out of definitely secular education. I believe it to a large extent our secular society, a secular culture, the media, and everything related to various forms of media. So anyways, we run down on time this morning. I want to say thank you to Prescott Valley Christian Church. I'm going to have to run here, and we'll come back next week and pick this up. Prescott Valley Christian Church for their financial support for the program. Also, Palmer, Alaska, and the church up there that's supporting our program. It's very much appreciated. If you'd like to contact me, you may at jnay@creationscience.net. Please bring your questions. And if you don't agree with me, that is absolutely fine. As iron sharpens iron, so one man another. I do not think I have all this figured out, but I do believe that God gave us a reasonable faith, and we're called to give an account for the hope that we have, and I pray this program is being of some assistance to you in that. So with that, we'll close this morning.
Okay, and for those who want to contact you, give the website again, please.
The website is creationscience.net. You can go there and go on contact us, well, or contact me, or you can email me directly, jnay@creationscience.net.
All right, we'll see you back next week.
Listen for two new programs every Sunday morning right here on publicly supported KJAZZ. At 10 a.m., Sherry Cornett hosts Gourmet the Healthy Way, the program all about food and you. And then at 10:30, Sue Simarco is in with Pets Galore, Sue's Corner Pet Shop. Gourmet the Healthy Way and Pets Galore, Sunday morning starting at 10 a.m. right here on publicly supported KJAZZ.